Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavatahwai. Time now to take a look at some of the other economic headlines hitting the front pages in our info news section. Now, this piece of news got our attention first. Farmers and rights group boycott food summit over big business links. The focus said it was on agro-business rather than ecology, which has split groups invited to the planned UN conference on hunger. One of the big businesses, for example, is funded by Bill Gates. The farmers don't want things like precision agriculture, data collection, and genetic engineering to be executed in their farming practices, because that could hurt their bottom line. Now, moving on to news related to COVID, this got our attention. Drug lobby asking Biden to punish foreign countries who are pushing for low-cost vaccines. Now, Big Pharma is fighting for tight control over the COVID-19 vaccine production. In turn, it limits availability worldwide while reaping billions. Well, this definitely doesn't sound fair for the poorer countries that can't afford the high price of the vaccine, which would prolong the disease and thus negatively affect their economies. Okay, the U.S. recently passed the $1.9 trillion stimulus package. Well, that may sound good, but there are several drawbacks. I mean, if you're 25, for example, the new plan will strap you with $1,750 in annual interest by the time you reach 35. In terms of the U.S. debt, although it surged by $7 trillion under Trump, as you can see over here, it's going to go much higher under Biden. The national U.S. debt before the stimulus stood at $27.9 trillion. And finally, what is going on with the oil prices? Well, it seems that global oil demand is set to benefit from stronger economic recovery and vaccinations in the second half of this year. That's according to OPEC. Of course, as OPEC goes, production has been cut, which drives up the prices. Currently, the price of Brent crude is almost $70 a barrel, which is quite amazing when you think that less than a year ago, oil prices fell below zero. Okay, time now to take a look at our final report of the show, which looks at the ways that China and Russia have aligned themselves to the point where it is highly inconceivable how the U.S. can actually catch up to these two superpowers.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping and the Russian President Vladimir Putin have put economics at the center of their strategic partnership, a key pillar of their relationship. The relationship has reached a point that each has called each other the most important economic partner. Multiple projects in the pipeline, literally. Take this gas project, which connects Russia to China.
I think this is a major concern for the European Union and the West. What they are concerned about is the rise of China, which has been a major focus of Western discontent during the pandemic period, and the decline of what was once called the unipolar world, that is the United States, its massive economic and military and diplomatic influence in the world, also bolstered, of course, by its allies in the European Union, principally in Britain and so forth. So I think that they are worried that iron grip is loosening under the conditions of the pandemic.
Moscow and Beijing have also gone ahead to use their own national currencies more often in trade, as Russia's relations with the West deteriorate even further. The Russian president has also repeated how the role of the dollar should be revisited in global trade. Even Xi and Putin's signature economic visions appear complementary at first glance. Xi's Belt and Road Initiative has unleashed Chinese companies to build roads, railways, fiber optic cables, and other hard infrastructures across the Eurasian supercontinent and beyond.
Everyone's heard of the European Union, but what you may not know is that the largest economic union in the world, geographically at least, is actually right next door.
Meanwhile, Putin's Eurasian Economic Union harmonizes customs processes to create a single market among Russia, Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. And none of this comes as a surprise. The U.S. under the former President Trump targeted China in a trade war. Washington and Russia were also placed under Western sanctions.
And they are probably worried that Russia might grow closer to China at a time when China, of course, is really the rising power across Asia. So Russia has, you know, economic interests east and west. What they are worried about is the balance in that influence, and that Russia will become a more serious competitor to the European Union and the West. This is what's haunting them. It's not a serious concern for the democratic rights of the Russian people.
I'm pleased to welcome back one more time current affairs and impact analysts Mohan Abedin and Mark Sloboda. Okay, Mark, final question to you. Russia's economic ties with China have elevated both to such a level that some are saying that it may prevent the U.S.'s economic advancement. Particularly, if you look at the way that Russia has advanced, this way may be pushing the U.S. down the economic ladder. I mean, we have seen how China is set to overtake the U.S. economy by the year 2034, which was revised to 2028. Do you think resource-rich Russia and China together will be able to actually do that?
Yeah. So first of all, I mean, this has been a geoeconomic truth for decades now, that the neoliberal global economic architecture that the U.S. has set up over the decades, beginning with Bretton Woods, all the way up through, up to the last successful rounds of the World Trade Organization, the creation of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, and other ways that the U.S. Has leverage over the global financial system. This has actually resulted through the processes of globalization and capital seeking cheaper labor for production in a global shift in wealth and economic power away from the United States and towards the East, in particular, China and more generally in Asia.
Mohan Abedin, current affairs and impact analyst, thank you so much for your thoughts.
You're welcome.
Taking a look at trade between the EU and Russia. As an example, January through March 2020, the turnover between Russia and the European Union decreased by 10.1% year on year, which was down to 52.3 billion euros. This table over here shows the first quarter of each year from the year 2018, moving on to 2019 and 2020. This here are the trade flows going from the EU to the Russian Federation, and over there from the Russian Federation or Russia to the EU. Now, your countries, well, they had an increase by 4.6% in Q1 2020, which made for about 20.6 billion euros. Exports from Russia to the EU declining by 17.7%, which is down to 31.7 billion euros. Bad news then, right? Wrong. This is actually what has happened. Now, 5 years ago, the Russian economy was teetering on the brink. Following Moscow's invasion and the annexation of Crimea in March 2014, where some countries imposed powerful economic sanctions on Russia, which coupled with a steep decline in the price of oil, could have brought the Kremlin to its knees. Let's move on to the next graph so we can talk about it. Here, this is from the Financial Times. By many metrics, Russia's $1.7 trillion economy looks to be actually in a better shape today than it has done for quite some time. Growth is slower, but more stable. A $124 billion sovereign fund has actually been created. Exporters have found new markets, and importers have found domestic alternatives. So much for Western sanctions and their intended goal, which has fallen short again. For Russia, the decline of Europe and the rise of Asia presents a historical opportunity. After COVID-19, the U.S. has seen that it's, well, moving downward in its economic output. And then you have the EU that's struggling, its member countries really struggling economically in terms of their GDP output. In that respect, one wonders whether they even grew out of the European debt crisis. Why would Russia want to deal then with the U.S. and the EU as the U.S. continues to sanction it along with the EU? Well, it has the opportunity to partner up with the economic powerhouse to soon take the economic reins away from the U.S., namely China. The East is further progressing, as it was evident with the formation of its biggest trading bloc in the world, namely the RCEP. That was 8 years in the making. Some of the countries included there were South Korea, China, Australia, and of course, we could take a look at other Southeast Asian countries. So it seems like the economies of the East is where Russia would benefit most, though it may still want to have minimal trade with some of the European countries that are willing to trade with Russia and not worry about the sanctions that have been imposed on it both by the EU and the US. Well, that does it for this edition of Economic Divide. We always enjoy having you on this program. From Mikhail Vitalik, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. Nowruz is an ancient Iranian feast which has remained fresh for several millennia. Many of the current customs in the world have their roots in the past. Nowruz is a great Iranian feast that has been mixed with the culture of this land and the neighboring nations as they used to be part of the greater Iran. Nowruz brings joy and hope with itself. It is celebrated among various ethnicities and religions. Some researchers believe that great events and feasts like Nowruz originate from myth. According to experts, myth consists of the things that are related to the era of primitive man and his life on planet Earth. In those days, human beings often forged ideas and imaginations which became sacred later on. In next eras, when myths lost their sanctity, other thoughts and beliefs replaced them. These myths and even epics that had lost their social value were known as legends. However, some myths could survive during the ups and downs of time and place. Nowruz is one of these myths. There are different accounts on the origins of Nowruz. But for sure, Nowruz is a feast that is closely linked with the change of season. In ancient times, seasons were different in length and various divisions can be found for them in books. But the ancient Iranians had divided the year into six unequal parts and maintained that, in the beginning of each part, Ahura Mazda had created a pre-model for the universe, including the sky, the earth, plants, useful animals, and man. They believed that Ahura Mazda had done the job in six unequal junctures during a year. Thus, creation or genesis set the ground for feasts in ancient Iran, which were called Gahambars. In those feasts, people would praise Ahura Mazda and thank him for his bounties. Each Gahambar lasted for 5 days. The last feast of the year coincided with the anniversary of man's creation. Thus, Nowruz is the anniversary of man's creation as the most valuable creature of God Almighty. There are many other legends that attribute Nowruz feast to the era of Jamshid. It is said that Jamshid was one of the rulers of Pishdadian dynasty. According to the Iranian myth, he came to the throne on Nowruz and revived religion on this day. Pishdadi rulers were the first dynasty of kings in the Iranian myths. This has been mentioned in Shahnameh, the magnum opus of the renowned Iranian epic poet Ferdowsi. Another account says that Ahriman, that is the devil, had annihilated bounties so that people would not get satisfied of eating and drinking. Wind would not stop so that all trees were dried and the world was in the brink of destruction. Upon the order of Yazdan, that is God, Jamshid rushed to the residence of Ahriman and his followers and fought them. This caused the end of misery and the world returned to the days of bounties, and this victory was like a radiant sun astonishing people. Hence, people shouted Nowruz, meaning new day. There is little account on the details of Nowruz celebrations in the era of Achaemenid and Ashkanid dynasties. A few historical narrations show that Nowruz used to be celebrated during the Achaemenid dynasty. It is narrated that when Cyrus triumphed over Babylon, introduced his son Cambyses as the king of Mesopotamia, simultaneous with Nowruz feast. Moreover, it seems that the glorious Taht-e Jamshid, Persepolis Palace, had been the place of annual Nowruz celebrations. All nations that were under the Achaemenid rule would converge there on this day to offer their presents to the king. They would ascend splendid steps of the palace and through the gates to enter the 100-pillar palace. The famous relief design in Taht-e Jamshid, which shows the battle of lion and bull, can be the symbol of victory of vernal equinox over winter. This is because lion is the symbol of the sun and the bull is the symbol of rain. This relief design shows that there had been an annual feast in Iran which was related to the change of seasons, and that was Nowruz. Myths and historical narrations indicate that Nowruz is a symbol of renewal and development, and it is intertwined with the cycle of nature. It is the feast that is held in the start of the vernal equinox, bringing about freshness and vividness. Vernal equinox, March, is one of the two annual equinoxes. The other one is the autumnal equinox, September. The vernal equinox in the northern hemisphere coincides with the autumnal equinox in southern hemisphere. That's why the vernal equinox is celebrated with Nowruz in the northern hemisphere. Nowruz has survived throughout centuries despite changes and developments in lands and regions. Nowruz is a bridge that connects all Iranians from every race, language, and color of skin. Nowruz is the great national feast of all Iranians and those who belong to the Iranian culture and civilization. We will elaborate more on the customs of Nowruz in the next episode.
September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown directly to the twin World Trade Center buildings in New York City. A few days later, U.S. Congress passed a resolution which has been used to justify Washington's military interventions abroad and detentions in Guantanamo Bay prison since. The authorization of the use of military force, or AUMF, granted the U.S. President the authority to use force against those who were involved in the 9/11 attacks. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called War on Terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. According to the Cost of War Project reports, since 2003, over 9.2 million Iraqis have been displaced across the country or have become refugees abroad. Washington is also responsible for around 300,000 deaths in Iraq between 2003 and 2009, a figure that could be much higher. Over two-thirds were civilians. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. That's while during the 2016 presidential campaigns, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. But Washington's acts did not end there. In 2020, four members of the U.S. private military firm Blackwater were pardoned. That is while Blackwater's mercenaries were prosecuted and found guilty of multiple criminal acts committed during a 2007 massacre at Nisr Square in Baghdad, which left 17 unarmed civilians dead and at least 20 wounded. The U.S.-led war in Iraq has had its negative impact on American people's lives as well. U.S. taxpayers have paid nearly $2 trillion in war-related costs on the Iraq War alone. That's an average of $8,000 per person and represents 9% of the national debt.
What the U.S. intended to do in Iraq is exactly what we see right now. The outcome that they were looking for is the destruction of the country, its continuous chaos in this country, in order for them to loot all the resources at the lowest cost.
A recent report published by the Cost of War Project says the U.S. military has conducted so-called counter-terror activities in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. The U.S. troops have also conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Moreover, Washington owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That is, while China is the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. The ongoing war on terror has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and over 335,000 civilians have lost their lives.
The war on terrorism is a war for terrorism. when in reality, the terrorism being created by the United States, the intended target is the destruction of the Arab and Muslim people.
After spending over $6.4 trillion and ruining lives of millions during the War on Terror campaign, Washington has failed to win a single war as of yet. With that, why does Washington fail to learn its lesson? The U.S. should correct the course now by repealing the 2002 AUMF.
The United States and China have held their first high-level in-person talk since President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office in Alaska on Thursday. The growing rift between the two nations was made evident before the media as diplomats traded barbs during the opening session, a formal function in diplomatic talks that's supposed to take minutes, which in this case lasted for an hour. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken said the issue of Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on United States, blame on China, and what he called Beijing's economic coercion toward Washington's allies would be discussed during the two-day talks. In response, China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi slammed the U.S. for interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The official also lashed out at Washington for what he called its struggling democracy and poor treatment of minorities. He also sharply criticized the U.S. foreign and trade policy. Blinken accused China of grandstanding during the public meeting, while his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi slammed the U.S., quote, inhospitality.
I think that the Chinese representatives were not expecting a friendly meeting, but I think we're surprised by the how intensely aggressive and hostile the statements were coming from the U.S. side. The Biden administration's attitude toward China and orientation toward China is even more hostile and belligerent and aggressive than was Trump. Every day there's something new.
Experts also believe the first major meeting between the two superpowers suggests that a reset of ties is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. During the bitter talks, the United States accused China of human rights violations. The Chinese foreign minister was quick to respond. He noted that the U.S. no longer has the qualification to speak to China from a position of strength, adding that many Americans have little confidence in the U.S. democracy.
In the United States, police kill over 1,100 people on the average year, and that's over the last 6 years. That's three a day. There's no other advanced capitalist country, developed capitalist country, that comes even close. Canada's the next one. And the U.S. rate is four times Canada's, but it's 27 times the rate in Germany and 67 times the rate of police killing in England and Wales. So those are very serious violations of human rights. There's great poverty in large sections of the U.S. and no prospects for getting better. That's a violation of human rights. So this very condescending attitude that the U.S. representatives are taking, and their idea that they can lecture others about human rights in the world, is I think much refuted by people all over the world, the governments and people all over the world today.
As part of his go-it-alone policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump provoked an all-out trade war with China, imposing several rounds of tariffs against billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports, a move that Beijing retaliated. The Trump administration also sanctioned several Chinese officials and major companies over a variety of different allegations, ranging from human rights violations to threatening the U.S. national security. During the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign, Trump's fellow Republicans feared that Joe Biden would adopt a soft stance on China. However, top Republicans have in recent weeks voiced approval of Biden's attempts to reset relations with Washington's allies and uniting them against China. Although the Biden administration is yet to clearly define its China policy, the opening of the first major meeting between the two sides served as a preview of what lies ahead for the two nations for at least the next 4 years.
Legal filings submitted by the British law firm quote speeches where the Syrian First Lady praises the mothers of Syrian soldiers killed on the front line. It also points to interviews where she supports her husband and soldiers for defending their homeland. The law firm says The evidence compiled, in our view, legally speaking, far exceeds what may be considered reasonable comment or mere propaganda and amount to the incitement, encouragement, and or aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Again, analysts question why there has been no investigation for a single politician whose country has committed war crimes, such as leaders and officials in the US or the UK and France.
The West takes it upon itself that they can attack and invade countries at will, and everything they do is justified, even if it's based on fabricated evidence, like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and of course the attack on Syria. This is, the United States, even under Obama, which was much better, was illegally invading countries. There was no justification, no resolution from the UN Security Council, and it was pure hypocrisy that Syria represented a threat to the United States, or this is a defense of war.
The timing of this move raises further question marks. On Monday, the UK had imposed new sanctions on six Syrian government officials, including the country's foreign minister. Now that the fighting has subsided in Syria and government forces have the upper hand against terror groups, any military plots to overthrow the government appear to have failed. Could the West be looking at new ideas to destabilize the country? Syria faces fresh problems today, including the spread of the coronavirus and the state of its economy. American forces are occupying the country's east, where the oil reserves are, thereby preventing Damascus from using its oil revenue to rebuild vital infrastructure. The US and Israel continue to launch airstrikes. Syria also accuses the European Union of being responsible for the suffering and bloodshed of civilians, saying the bloc, along with Britain, has backed terrorist groups. Yet, civilians are starting to return to many liberated parts of their homeland, including entire provinces that had been destroyed by various terror groups. Researchers say since March 2011, Washington has led a coalition of NATO countries, Arab monarchies, and Israel in a proxy regime change war using terrorist mercenaries as foot soldiers. Perhaps a wider investigation is needed to establish who supported the terrorists, who funded them, who backed them, who provided them with training, and who really committed war crimes in the Arab country. Britain's Metropolitan Police have opened a preliminary investigation into the wife of Syria's First Lady, Asma al-Assad. A London-based law firm has filed a complaint over allegations of incitement and encouragement to commit acts of terrorism. Asma has dual British Syrian nationality and could reportedly lose her British citizenship and have an international arrest warrant issued if convicted. The Metropolitan Police say it received a referral in July last year relating to the ongoing Syrian conflict. In a statement, the Met says the referral is in the process of being assessed by officers from the War Crimes Unit. British media suggests police are considering whether there is enough evidence to carry out a full investigation. This is why the analysts say there is sufficient evidence to investigate former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for his leading role in the invasion of Iraq.
A total double standard. Actually, Tony Blair admitted that that George Bush was fabricating evidence against Syria. For the war, of course, Blair has been invading a country. There's no legitimate reason for that. Which plus American troops are there at the present time, and British troops are actually even in Syria and French troops for a very long period of time, which does constitute a war crime.
As a result of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed. The invasion also led to the birth of terrorist groups that had no presence in the country before. These terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Daesh, have killed and raped locals on a mass scale and ravaged the entire country. Yet the perpetrators of the invasion and its aftermath continue to live a lavish lifestyle. On the other hand, Asma al-Assad has suffered from cancer and has paid a considerable amount being treated for the disease, which raises questions over her role in the alleged crimes committed.
The COVID-19 pandemic has been negatively affecting minorities in the UK, especially the British Muslims. The coronavirus outbreak has caused hardships for a record number of Muslims in the country, with the faith group experiencing a fall into poverty at a much higher rate than the rest of the British population. Also, the demand for help among them has doubled within a year. According to the National Zakat Foundation and Islamic Relief UK, requests for financial help have risen from about 15 per day before the first lockdown measures were introduced in the country to over 70 per day toward the end of 2020. The National Zakat Foundation says it has offered £3.8 million in grants. The figure represented a 27% increase compared to the previous year. The charitable organization offers such grants from Zakat, the obligatory religious levy collected from British Muslims.
Day in, day out, Muslims are being attacked on media by politicians of all persuasion, you know, left, right, every aspect of their lives is being associated with terrorism, with negativity, and this has an impact. I mean, this will have impact both financially and psychologically on the Muslim community. Even Muslim organizations are not really adhered or supported.
With the second Ramadan and lockdown fest approaching, the national charity says funds are still urgently needed to respond to the continuing high demand for help. With the vast majority of Zakat typically given during Ramadan, the National Zakat Foundation is now urgently seeking funds to ensure they can meet the needs of the community in the weeks and months ahead. Figures from the Muslim Census Organization reveal the community has been falling into poverty at a rate 10 times higher than the UK population. The report also revealed that job losses among British Muslims have been 6 times greater compared to the rest of the population since the pandemic began. It also showed that 42% of Muslims surveyed had used their savings to cover their expenses during the pandemic. This is compared to a recent study by AJ Bell, an investment company, which recorded that 30% of UK people have had to use their savings. As well as facing poverty, Muslim communities are especially vulnerable to coronavirus, as many live in extended households where elderly people and those with existing health conditions are most at risk. Key workers such as NHS staff and transport workers from these families also have the additional fear of catching the virus. But there are other factors involved, including health inequalities.
Muslims, due to Islamophobia, and they have become second-class citizens in their own countries, in Britain, France, Germany, and most of the Western world. And they are being discriminated. They are the first one to be fired. They are the last one to be hired.
Experts believe the problem with the UK's health system is that people aren't getting the information and support they need.
It's not something that is just happening last week or last month. It's been going on for a very long time, and nothing is being done about it. Governments, not only they're not making an attempt to stop it, they are, them themselves and the politicians are actually contributing to ever-increasing environment of hate against Muslims.
They say, as the pandemic comes to an end, the British government needs to reinvest in services that support people's health and ensure they're culturally and linguistically inclusive and accessible to people from all communities.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC.
Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly.
The more the Islamic government expands, the wider the scope of the Islamic government's activities becomes, the more arenas open to the Islamic Republic, and the more challenges it faces, challenges that did not used to exist in the past. As with the passage of time, there will be new challenges, arenas, and tasks for the Islamic government, the more it needs to update that software and that spiritual system. This is what I want to say.
این اون چیزی که از فضلای صاحب نظر و متفکر به جد باید مطالبه بشه و این کار باید انجام بگیره.
This is what should be seriously demanded from intellectual and bright scholars, and this should be done. When we speak about updating the Islamic philosophy and about renewing and modernizing the Islamic ideological system, this does not mean tampering with that spiritual system in any way. Rather, it means that there are certain truths in the book and in the sunnah to which we did not pay careful attention as long as we do not need them. Only when we begin to need them, we become aware of them. There are many examples in this regard, and I will cite a few ones here.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
For example, the Islamic government is faced with conditional pressures imposed by the enemy. By conditional pressures, I mean that they exert a pressure such as sanctions, and later on, they say that they will lift them provided that such and such a thing will be done. It is not the case that they thwart us completely. Rather, they say that they will lift them if such and such a thing is done. Well, This is a very dangerous and important issue. These conditions might be extremely misleading and lethal conditions. What should we do in such circumstances?
در یه چنین وضعی انسان چیکار باید بکنه؟ اینجا انسان متوجه میشه که فستقم کما امرت و من تاب معک علاج اینه.
In such situations, we notice that the cure for this is to act on this ayah. Therefore, stand firm on the straight path as you are commanded, you and those who with you turn unto Allah.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
For decades now, people of Kashmir haven't witnessed any celebrations. The conflict in the region has always spoiled their joy and happiness. However, when it comes to Nowruz festival, which marks the beginning of spring, hope for a better tomorrow gives people of this war-weary region a chance to rejoice. Now people have gathered in the heart of Kashmir's capital city of Srinagar, where almond trees are blossoming to mark the arrival of spring.
People of Kashmir have nothing to rejoice, and we have faced turmoil for decades. But when we see the cycle of life in nature and how life is revived, I and many like me begin to revive too. We only hope to have a spring year round, since we have missed it for decades.
Youngsters are busy clicking on images and filling their social media timelines, while others are enjoying the beauty of fresh blooms. And to add to this glory, Kashmir's administration has organized a concert.
Spring will soon begin, and we want it to start on a happy note. We want people of Kashmir to be full of hope, energy, and enthusiasm, so that this energy boosts their morale throughout the year.
Nowruz, a Persian tradition of welcoming spring, became part of the culture of Kashmir after Persian scholars and saints came to Kashmir and preached Islamic teachings centuries ago. Since then, Kashmir and Persia have shared many similarities, including food. Here at the Little Persia, friends and families have gathered in Kashmir's only Persian food-serving restaurant to celebrate the occasion of Nowruz. The owner says the practice aims to retain the fantastic culture of Persia through food.
I came back to Kashmir like 7 years before. I noticed I was always intrigued by the cultural similarities we have with the Persian community, or per se like the Iranian community, or with Iran. So I noticed those similarities, and I dwelled in the history and in the books of, like, you know, of a tradition, and then I got to know, like, you know, we were one of the tribes that actually came from there, and then we settled here. So our culture is, like, majorly influenced and pretty much originates from that part of the world.
Picturesque Kashmir, known as the Venice of East, attracts tourists from around the globe. However, decades of turmoil and now the COVID-19 pandemic have pushed the region's economy to its ever lowest. Nowruz symbolizes hope, revival, and life. People of Kashmir say no one other than those suffering in this world would realize the importance of a new beginning, and they only hope to see their spring season last long. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Thank you.
The 6th of Shaban is the title of the latest retaliatory attack carried out by the Yemeni army against one of Aramco oil sites in the Saudi capital Riyadh using drones. The Yemeni army says the operation comes in response to the Saudi continued deadly aggression.
The Yemeni army will continue its strategic operations deep inside Saudi Arabia until the sources of oil dry up. And Aramco, the source of Saudi economy, is destroyed. We will force the Saudi enemy to realize the reality of our capabilities. These operations will continue until the war is stopped and the blockade imposed on our country is lifted.
The Saudi regime confirmed the attack, saying it has caused a fire in the oil refinery in Riyadh and it was controlled. Observers say the Yemeni army should continue such attacks to deal heavy damage to the Saudi economy.
These operations will not have an impact unless the oil facilities are continuously attacked. The oil is the lifeline of the Saudi economy, and Saudi Arabia is using oil money to buy mercenaries and weapons. So these operations must not stop.
For 6 years now, Yemenis have been under a devastating war imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies that caused the death of tens of thousands of people. Many of them are women and children. Riyadh has also forced an all-out blockade on Yemen, which has caused more deaths than weapons had.
Yemenis say the army has the right to continue targeting Saudi facilities until Riyadh stops its years-long war and siege against them and releases the illegally detained oil ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the past 15 years, these shanties have been the new homes of Rohingya refugees. A scattered community dwelling here with no proper sanitation facilities and unhygienic conditions. To them, what matters is to survive, and that's all they've been trying to get. Escaping persecution at the hands of authorities in Myanmar, the Muslim Rohingya community has been fleeing their homes for safer locations. But decades have passed, and they still have no place to call home.
A decade ago, we left Rakhine because they were mercilessly killing people from our community. Our women were raped and children were taken into forced labor. For the sake of life and honor, we moved out of bloody place, but our ill fate loomed over us everywhere. We are being forced out of everywhere.
New Delhi's recent crackdown on illegal immigrants in the Jammu region landed over 160 Rohingya refugees in detention centers, which has forced others to flee the makeshift camp. The refugees are now heading to unknown locations.
This time, the authorities have rejected our UNHCR cards. They have taken our men and we are left helpless. The silence of the global Muslim community towards our plight has made our lives miserable.
Since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India, minorities in the country are feeling the heat. The BJP introduced the Citizenship Amendment Bill in 2019. It grants Indian citizenship to Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Sikhs and other minorities who fled neighboring countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan before 2014, fearing religious persecution. However, the Citizenship Amendment Act discriminates against Muslims and violates the rights of equality enshrined in the Constitution of India. In the state of Assam, illegal immigrants from Bangladesh have long been a source of concern for India. Accordingly, around 2 million residents were left off the National Citizenship Register, a majority of them Muslims. The register is a list of people who can prove they had entered India by March 1971, right before neighboring Bangladesh became an independent country. Analysts say the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party aims at transforming India into a majoritarian community by granting citizenship rights to majority groups. And all this has dented India's democratic image globally and has downgraded India from a democracy to an electoral autocracy. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The first high-level meeting between the U.S. and China under Joe Biden's presidency gets off to a frosty start, putting the deeply strained relations between the two countries on public display. The opening session of a two-day meeting in Alaska saw top American and Chinese officials hurling accusations at each other in front of the world media. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of threatening the global stability, conducting cyber attacks against the U.S., and practicing economic coercion. He also lashed out at Beijing for what he called committing human rights violations, including in Hong Kong. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi reacted by calling the U.S. allegations hypocritical. He noted that Washington's own human rights records are at a low point, especially with regard to its treatment of African Americans who are being, quote, slaughtered there. Yang also accused Washington of using its military might and financial power to suppress other countries. The senior Chinese official said Washington, with its unfounded allegations, is trying to obstruct normal trade exchanges and inciting some countries to attack China. The two top economies have been at loggerheads for years over a host of issues, including trade, cybersecurity, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. The U.S. has also been on the forefront over China's maritime dispute with some of its neighbors over the South China Sea, siding with Beijing's rivals and routinely dispatching warships and warplanes to the region. Experts believe the U.S. is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power.
The United States is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power. Now, China has an economy that's roughly half the size of that of the United States, but China has been making gains on the United States, as we know, in recent years.
The Sino-American relations sank to their lowest level under former President Donald Trump, who initiated a trade war with China using tariffs as a pressure tool. The Biden administration has taken a somber approach as it views the Sino-American relations as the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. However, it has so far refrained from rolling back Trump's policies to mend bilateral relations. It appears Biden is following in Trump's footsteps not only with regard to China, but other global issues. 2 months after his inauguration, Biden has also failed to live up to his campaign promise of returning to the UN-endorsed 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was signed during his vice presidency but abandoned by Trump in 2018. Iran says Biden is no different from his predecessor when it comes to honoring the accord. Tensions have also escalated between Moscow and Washington in recent days, with Russia warning that bilateral ties are, quote, on the brink of collapse, that after the U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer and warned that Vladimir Putin will pay the price for what he claimed meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
Belgium's largest COVID-19 vaccination center, located in Hazel on the outskirts of Brussels city. Like hundreds of similar venues across the EU, officials here are worried about vaccine supply. 33-year-old nurse Alex Gavoni has arrived to get the jab.
I have a vaccination center behind my house, but I could not go there because they don't have enough supplies. And this place is a bit far away from me, for the other people that have to come. And as a nurse, I'm a bit concerned that the people will not take the vaccine because of the confusion with AstraZeneca for the moment.
AstraZeneca is contracted to supply the EU with 90 million doses before the end of this month, but will only deliver 30 million. The firm is supposed to supply 180 million doses in April, May and June, but says it will only provide 70 million.
AstraZeneca has underproduced and underdelivered.
Key EU member states will start to administer AstraZeneca again after being reassured by health authorities amid safety concerns.
This is a safe and effective vaccine.
Experts are asking, due to the EU's dismal handling of the affair, how many people will be willing to take the jab. In any case, the German government says there are not enough vaccines in the EU to prevent a third wave. For example, infection rates are again out of control in France and Italy. Health officials say the UK variant of the virus is wreaking havoc in Poland. Many hospitals are reaching breaking point. Health experts warn that when centres are not being fully utilised, COVID-19 mutations are allowed to develop in the community. The big concern is future variants might be even more contagious and more deadly. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.